Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Summer is a little different this year, but it's still a great time to learn, explore, and have adventures. Welcome to Talk of Iowa Summer Camp. Every Tuesday all summer long, our camp will have a different theme, and this week it's astronomy. We will explore the universe this hour, and you can find more ways to explore and learn on our website, iowapublicradio.org. Our camp directors this hour are Cornelia Lang, Professor and Director of Undergraduate Studies in the Physics and Astronomy Department at the University of Iowa. Hello, Cornelia.
Hi, Charity. It's so great to be here.
Caroline Roberts is also here, Astronomy Laboratory Coordinator and Van Allen Observatories Manager at the University of Iowa. Hello, Caroline.
Hi, Charity. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you both for being here. And we're going to start really, really, really big and work to just really, really big. But Cornelia, why don't you start us off? We talk a lot about the universe. We talk about the universe in many different ways. What is the universe?
Oh, boy, that's a big question. So we define the universe as the collection of all things that we know of. The universe encompasses very large, on the largest scale, we have what we call superclusters of galaxies. These are really beautiful sort of chains of clusters of thousands and thousands of galaxies. The galaxy clusters break down into galaxy groups. Galaxies themselves are collections of hundreds of billions of stars, and those stars, many of them have planets around them. So the universe is all of those things together, and one of the jobs of astronomers is to try to disentangle and study the structure of all those things.
And the universe is really almost too big to comprehend. How can we understand how big it is?
It is really, really big to comprehend. I think there's some easy things to think about when we comprehend the universe. I mean, one thing to remember is that distances in astronomy, distances in the universe, are much vaster than we can really even comprehend. I mean, when you think about the distances between planets in the solar system, that's our solar system, the group of planets that orbit our star, they're really, really large. To put it into perspective, the nearest star to the sun is 4 light years away. This is the Alpha Centauri system. That star, the closest star of 100 billion in our galaxy, or maybe 200 billion, is 25.5 trillion miles from the sun. And using the current technology of, you know, the fastest spacecraft that NASA knows how to fly, it would take almost 100,000 years even just for us to get to the nearest star, okay? So that's one way to start thinking about just how vast distances are. And that's just in our solar neighborhood.
It's a big neighborhood. And Caroline, let's take it just a little bit smaller. Let's talk about the galaxy that we live in, the Milky Way.
Absolutely. So our Milky Way galaxy is a large but pretty typical galaxy. There are a lot of galaxies that are smaller, more diffuse, or larger and very round in shape. But our galaxy is a spiral galaxy. Nearby, there are a few galaxies that look like ours, the Andromeda galaxy, very close by, has a similar spiral shape. The Triangulum galaxy is also near and looks pretty similar. But in our general area, our local groups that Cornelia mentioned, we're one of the big kids on the playground. This Milky Way galaxy got this spiral structure. And we're about a third of the distance out from the center. Our sun, our star, our solar system is not at the center of the Milky Way galaxy, but it's also not on the outskirts either.
So, then Caroline, we're having a little bit of trouble understanding you. You're sounding a little bit muffled. So I think we're going to put you on hold for a moment, and Rick Brewer, our producer, is going to work on helping you sound a little more clear. But Cornelia, I'll let you pick up the thread there.
Sure.
We were talking about our solar system and our place within the Milky Way galaxy. Of course, often humans feel like we're at the center of the universe, at the center of our galaxy, and we are definitely not. But give us a little bit more of an idea of our place within the Milky Way.
Yeah, so as Caroline said, our sun, around which the Earth orbits, is about a third or a half of the way out in our Milky Way. So the distance between the sun and the center of the galaxy is about 25,000 light years. So when we receive light in our telescopes here on Earth from the center of our galaxy, we're looking at light that left that region 25,000 years ago. I actually study the very center of the Milky Way. That's what my research is on. And it's a very, very active place. I mean, one of the ways to think about the sun compared to the center of the galaxy is, for instance, Iowa City is a very good representation of the sun in a very kind of comfortable solar neighborhood. The living is easy here. It's a beautiful day outside. There's not much, too much in, you know, disruption. The center of the galaxy is like downtown New York City or downtown Hong Kong. There are many more clouds. There are many very strong forces, like the gravitational forces, the tidal forces are very, very strong. You have many more objects concentrated into a very small amount of space. And so if we want to get a handle on what happens in the centers of other galaxies, one of the places we look is to the center of our galaxy, where we actually have a pretty good view at only 25,000 light years from us.
Well, and when we are studying what's going on in our galaxy, we're looking at the past. We can't really study the present moment, can we?
No. I mean, I would say in the continuum of in the big history perspective, in the long history of the universe, 25,000 years is a blink of an eye. Okay. So when you are an astronomer, you really have to adjust the way that you think about time. And so you're absolutely right. Unless the objects are very close, we're not seeing things in real time. And so the way that astronomers put together a picture of how objects in the sky change is to look at the variety of objects. So for instance, we know the sun is going to change a lot over its lifetime, but its lifetime is 10 billion years. We're not sitting around waiting for those changes to happen, but we look at objects that represent what the sun will look like in 3 billion years, or what the sun looked like when it formed. And then astronomers are very creative, and we get to put together a picture or a model of how we think the sun will live its life.
So it sounds like we need to embrace not only a different idea of time, but a different idea of distance and space when we think about the galaxy.
Right. And one of the things I teach a couple of courses where I teach with faculty from other disciplines, because the field of astrobiology is one where you need biologists on hand, you need chemists, you need geologists. And so one of the things that's funny in our class is we talk about evolution. And I listened to your excellent program on evolution a few weeks ago, and astronomers use the word evolution very differently. We don't have the biological part of it, but for us, evolution means the way that astronomical objects change over their long histories of time.
All right. So we've talked about the universe, and we've talked about our galaxy. Caroline is back with us. Hello, Caroline.
Oh, good. Yeah. Hello, Charity. Hi, Cornelia.
And so, Caroline, let's talk about our solar system, because I think when we learn about space in school, probably the solar system is where we start.
Yeah, it's a fantastic place to start. Our solar system, we're finding, is a bit more atypical than you would have expected. Our solar system has four rocky planets near the sun, four large gaseous planets towards the outskirts of the solar system. But in part, just the demographics of what we're finding as we study other solar systems,
but also in part because of the biases, because of the instruments that we've had to use so far. We're finding that other solar systems have a lot more of these giant gaseous planets very close to their star. And again, that's because they're big planets, it's easy to detect those. But it is also a little bit interesting that our solar system is so different. Our Earth is the third planet from the sun. But of course, there's other things in the solar system as well. We have moons of these planets. We have smaller, rocky, usually bodies that in some cases were even considered or were planets in the past. Pluto, of course, is one of these smaller dwarf planets, but there's others too. And it was the finding of those other dwarf planets that really made us have to reconsider, can Pluto be a planet? But there are comets, asteroids as well.
I think a lot of people still feel very sad about Pluto getting downgraded. That's an emotional touchstone for a lot of us.
It is. And it's still a wonderful part of the solar system. I love the fact that we found that one of the features, the Tombaugh Regio on the dwarf planet Pluto, appears to have a heart in appearance. But at the end of the day, you know, that's one of the great things about science is science allows us to re-examine new information and change our views if we need to. And I think that's one of the powerful lessons of science.
Well, and I think it's also a really interesting thing to think about, something that generations of humans have grown up knowing for certain, turns out not to be the case. That's that's pretty humbling, I think.
It's really interesting. Yeah, it's interesting when you look at the way in which people over time have looked at the motion, even just something as simple as the motion of the bodies in the night sky and where things are relative to one another. And there's so much history tied up in that, and there's so much religion and worldviews. It's and to look at how those things have changed are very valuable lessons for us.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. It's Talk of Iowa Summer Camp today. We are kicking off a summer where every Tuesday all summer long we'll have a different theme. Today, astronomy camp, and with us Cornelia Lang, professor and director of undergraduate studies in the physics and astronomy department at the University of Iowa, and Caroline Roberts, Astronomy Laboratory Coordinator, and Val Allen, Observatories Manager at the University of Iowa. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa Summer Camp starts today. Every Tuesday all summer long, our camp will have a different theme. And today, we're at Astronomy Camp. Our camp directors are Cornelia Lang, Professor and Director of Undergraduate Studies in the Physics and Astronomy Department at the University of Iowa, and Caroline Roberts, Astronomy Laboratory Coordinator and Van Allen Observatories Manager at the University of Iowa. And you are welcome to join the conversation. If you are a younger person and you have asked your parents a question that they have said, I don't know, maybe you should go to the computer and see what Neil deGrasse Tyson says about that. This is your opportunity to ask that question. You can give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And all right, we were talking about our solar system. Here we are on that third rock from the sun. And Cornelia, what should we understand about our place within the solar system? There is a lot about humanity and about life on Earth that is due to our location. Location, 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 right?
That's true. We are in our star's habitable zone. And one of the ways we like to talk about that in some of our courses is the Goldilocks zone. So you will remember the story about Goldilocks where the porridge is too hot, there's a porridge that's too cold, and there's a porridge that's just right. And I think that happens with chairs and beds. And so what happens with the planet Earth is that its location from our sun allows water to be in liquid form at the temperatures that the Earth is. So that's, for example, we have our planet covered with oceans. If we were at the location of Venus, it would be too warm and the oceans would evaporate. And if we were at the location of Mars, we would have frozen water on the planet's surface. Now, it's a little more complicated than that because there are also planetary atmospheres and they strongly control and regulate temperatures. But the simple way to think about it is that the Earth is in just the right location in our solar system to have liquid water, which is one of the ingredients necessary for life as we know it.
If we are interested in finding out more about the stars and the planets and our solar system and beyond, you know, a lot of us go outside at night and we look up at the sky and we see these stars and it's beautiful, but we don't really have an understanding of what we're looking at. Caroline, how do you start making sense of what we can see from here on Earth?
Yeah, what's really incredible about looking up at the night sky is that some of the things that you see, some of those planets that are going to move in their position from night to night, are very nearby, and we're seeing them, you know, as they really were yesterday. But in general, when you look up at the sky, what's incredible is that you're looking back in time. You're looking at these stars outside of our solar system in our Milky Way galaxy, where the light actually left years ago, and light travels very fast. It travels as the fastest thing that we know of, but yet these distances of these stars are just so large that the light is arriving from years past. And so that's one thing to understand when you're looking up at the sky, is you're looking at a ton of different time capsules in every direction.
So you're looking into the past as you see those lights from the stars.
Yeah.
When you look at the sky with your bare eye,
yes.
What is the difference between looking with your eyes or looking through a telescope?
Yeah, the average person with their eyesight is able to see about 2,000 stars in the sky. That's a typical number of the number of bright stars that are out there that we can actually see with our eyes. Our eyes are just little detectors. They're collecting light in real time. But, you know, if we want to be able to see fainter objects, more stars, that's when we start using things like binoculars and telescopes.
Cornelia, when did you first start looking at the stars? What got you excited about astronomy when you were growing up?
Well, I grew up in northern Minnesota and North Dakota, so we had pretty dark skies. I remember learning some basic constellations. For me, honestly, it wasn't really till I got to college when I discovered astronomy. And so one of the favorite parts for me about my job now is working with students when they find their passion for astronomy or physics. So I owe a lot to my first and second year instructors in college for opening up my mind to the world of astronomy. But I do have memories of, I think one of the fantastic things you can see with your eyes, especially in the upper Midwest, is you can see Polaris, which is our the location of the North Star. And so the Big Dipper points to Polaris. And if you're out, say, camping during the summer and you're in a northern location, you can see the Big Dipper rotating around all night. You can see it rotating around Polaris. It's one of the constellations from our perspective in the northern hemisphere that doesn't set. A lot of constellations come up, they transit over their high point in the sky, and then they set in the other part of the sky, whereas the circumpolar constellations are up all night. And so the Big Dipper is one of those.
Our Earth is always rotating, and so the stars just appear to move.
So we're the ones who are moving, not the stars.
Right, yes.
So it's interesting to me, you mentioned constellations. In studying the stars, there seems to be a blend of science and mythology. Cornelia, how do you feel about the constellations and the stories that go along with them? Because it's a very different thing from actually studying the science of the stars.
Right. I love the constellations. I mean, what we have to remember, and again, what I teach in some of my big introductory courses, is the constellations are patterns. There is no physical relationship between those stars. They don't know about each other. So the constellations are a human imprint on a pattern. They're a human way to see patterns in the sky. And that is incredibly important for navigation, for storytelling. I mean, one of my favorite things, and I travel a lot for my work, and I've spent considerable time in Australia. First of all, the night sky looks totally different in Australia because you're so far south. And second of all, the mythologies and the patterns are fairly different. And I have a beautiful painting in my office called Seven Sisters Dreaming, which is an indigenous Aboriginal painting of the Seven Sisters constellation. You can barely see it from Northern Australia. So this artist would have known about it from Northern Australia. And it's just really reassuring to see that the sky is something that we all share. And I know that this is a really tough time for all of us in the world with the pandemic and some of the other stress and unrest that we have. And I think I do find comfort knowing that we all do share the same sky. And so that's why I think the constellations are a very human part of that.
And learning the constellations give us a map in the night mm-hmm. sky. Caroline, how can you sort of find your place within the night sky?
Yes. So as Cornelia was talking about, this North Star Polaris is located at the position in the sky that the North Pole on Earth points to. And so as the Earth turns, the stars are moving about the Polaris North Star. And so if you are in the Northern Hemisphere, you can always find that star to know the direction of north. The same is true in the Southern Hemisphere. You can find constellations that are located near to the South Celestial Pole, right up above the South Pole, and that will always point you south.
The other thing to point out with constellations, and I meant to say this earlier, is astronomers use them scientifically to help us find our objects. So, for instance, I study the very center of the Milky Way galaxy. It is a very small region projected onto the whole of the sky. So when I'm at a telescope or when I'm writing a computer program to tell a telescope where to look, I need to look, I need to know what general direction my object is. And the center of the galaxy happens to live in the direction of the constellation Sagittarius. So scientists also use the constellations to help find their way in the sky.
It's Talk of Iowa Summer Camp today. We are at Astronomy Camp with our camp directors today from the University of Iowa, Cornelia Lang and Caroline Roberts. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions and your observations. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So if I have a typical home telescope, one of the things that may be most interesting to look at is the moon. It's something that looks different through a telescope than what I can see with the naked eye. Caroline, gazing at the moon, what can I learn and what should I look for?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the best times to look at the moon when you're not using a telescope is when it's a very full phase or close to full. But when you're using a telescope, it might actually be best to look at the moon when it's at one of its crescent phases or when there's just a small amount of the moon visible or half the moon visible if it's a first quarter or last quarter moon. This is because the moon is incredibly bright, and unless you have a certain filter for your telescope, it's really going to be best to look at the moon when it's not full, because you'll really be able to see some of the shadow regions along what we call the edge of the phase of the moon, the terminator. You'll be able to see the craters and the light in and out of those craters. When you look at the moon, the dark regions are what we call the mare. These are lunar regolith, basaltic materials. The whiter parts on the moon are the highlands or the terra. Those are some features to look for with a telescope looking at the moon.
Cornelia, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Well, I was just going to say exactly what Caroline said and add that
the changes in coloration tell us about the moon's long history. And so Caroline mentioned the highlands and that are light in color and the darker lowlands. The darker lowlands represent places where ancient volcanoes on the moon smoothed over the more highland cratered surfaces. Now, the moon is full of craters because it lacks an atmosphere. And so it's really neat to think about those differences in color, telling you a little bit of a history of that object.
Go on, Caroline.
Pardon me. Just as the moon also tells us its history, it also tells us the history of the Earth. All the impacts that have happened to the moon have also happened to the Earth. We get hit by the same number of asteroids. It's just that on Earth we have a molten core. We have plate tectonics. The Earth is constantly resurfacing itself, smoothing over those craters, while the moon has no way of removing the craters that are formed.
Is there still something that we can learn about the moon, Cornelia?
Oh, there are many things that we can learn about the moon. We are grappling with whether or not the moon has a measurable magnetic field. There are colleagues in my department who are experts on the low-level magnetic activities on the moon. We know that the particles that stream off the surface of the sun in the solar wind. These are fast-moving electrons and protons. These are parts of atoms that have been plasmatized or are plasma that stream off the sun's surface. They are constantly interacting with the rest of the solar system. And so because the moon lacks a strong magnetic field and because the moon does not have an atmosphere, there's some very interesting particle interactions that can happen at the surface of the moon, and we think that the moon would have had a magnetic field in the past. It's cooled down, and so there are many, many lessons still to learn, Charity.
Is in the field of astronomy, is the moon an attractive thing to study, or does it feel a little been there, done that, as far as things that you can explore?
Well, one thing to point out is just like in any discipline, there is a huge variety in astronomy. And people, it's very funny, astronomers tend to categorize themselves by what type of object they study and what type of electromagnetic radiation they study. So I study the center of the galaxy and I use radio waves. So I am a galactic radio astronomer. Caroline, I think, could describe herself differently, right, Caroline?
That's right. Yeah, I studied extragalactic astronomy, so the centers of galaxies and the supermassive black holes that reside there.
So what does that say about you when you meet other astronomers and they tell you what they study? Does that give you an idea of who they are?
Sometimes. I think there are astronomers who study the moon and are very interested. I would tend to say that the folks that study the moon tend to be more space physicists and planetary geologists, because really to understand the moon, you have to have a deep background in geology to be able to put it into context. So there's just, what's fantastic about astronomy is there's something for everyone.
Well, I want to talk about the stars. And Cornelia, I'm going to ask you to describe stars for us, just because, Caroline, you are still a little bit muffled. And I know this is something we all want to hear loud and clear. So, Cornelia, introduce us to the concept of a star.
Well, the star is, first and foremost, the star is quite different than a planet. So a star, one of the definitions we use for a star is it is an astronomical object. It's a spherical object that is hot. It's very usually plasma. So that means it's at a temperature where atoms get separated into their components of protons and electrons and neutrons, or it's kind of a soup. And stars can create their own energy. So planets, while planets have some low-level sources of internal energy, especially a big planet like Jupiter, stars are an amazing resource of energy. So all stars have nuclear fusion happening at their cores. So they are taking elements and making new elements, and in that process they give us off copious amounts of energy that can sustain their lives over 10 billion years. And stars come in a wide variety of shapes and sizes. And the sun is, I wouldn't say it's typical, it's a little bit larger than typical, but it is a very constant sort of medium luminosity star.
We are going to take another short break. We'll be back. We'll talk more about stars and astronomy in a moment. With us this hour, we have our camp directors, Cornelia Lang, professor and director of undergraduate studies in the physics and astronomy department at the University of Iowa, and Caroline Roberts, astronomy laboratory coordinator and Van Allen Observatories manager at the University of Iowa. You are welcome to join the conversation, too, with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa summer camp starts today, every Tuesday all summer long. Our camp will have a different theme. And this week, it's astronomy. With us today, Cornelia Lang, professor and director of undergraduate studies in the physics and astronomy department at the University of Iowa, and Caroline Roberts, astronomy laboratory coordinator and Van Allen Observatories manager at the University of Iowa. We'll find out a little bit in a moment about how you can actually have access to the Van Allen Observatories without leaving your home this summer. Some virtual stargazing and learning coming up this month. And you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we were just talking about the sun before the break, and Chris in Cedar Rapids has a question about the sun. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, I had heard recently that our sun was kind of in a stall-out state, and I was curious as to, like, the details on that, how long that might last or how that would affect us here on Earth.
Cornelia?
So, sure. I think I'm not familiar with that stall out phase, but what I'm thinking is that we are this, as I've mentioned, the sun has a 10 billion year lifetime. It's formed from a collapsing cloud, and we are in the main part of its lifetime right now. In fact, we call it the main sequence, and this will last the majority of the sun's life. We don't expect the sun for another many billions of years to become a red giant and then a white dwarf. Later in the sun's life, it'll expand. It will get very, very large. It will cool down. It will actually consume the inner four planets, which is unfortunate for us here on Earth, but that is many billions of years from now. And then the sun will, the outer layers will become a beautiful planetary nebula, and the core will become a corpse known as a white dwarf.
In addition, the sun has an 11-year solar cycle, and so we're right now at the time of a solar minimum. There's no activity on the surface of the sun in terms of these darker regions where magnetic field lines are formed. I mean, we're at a solar minimum, but that will begin to end in a couple of years here now, and it's a normal part of the sun cycle.
Does that answer your question, Chris?
Yes, that's what I was curious. That's what I had heard. That's what I was curious about. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call. So this is part of a normal solar cycle. It sounds like we need to also remind ourselves again to think about time in a different way than we think about time here on Earth. I remember when I was growing up, learning that the sun would one day come to an end was a really difficult thing for me to learn. Cornelia, do you have some words of wisdom on that? Because I think a lot of us have a lot of fear when we hear that for the first time.
Right. No, it is true. And I have dealt with many students over the years who have gotten quite concerned and nervous and sent me some follow-up emails about that. I mean, it is a natural progression in nature. And we're, again, we're talking about the sun only being halfway through its life. So we have another 4.5 to 5 billion years before our sun will change, and it will change gradually. And so, the idea of thinking of about the outer layers of the red giant star kind of consuming the inner planets is it's a very visceral image, but it will happen slowly, and humanity at that point will not be, we will not have humans on Earth at that point. Our species has, you know, it's not, so far hasn't been that robust, and it'll remain to be seen what happens in the future. And so I think, you have to put your astronomy hat on when you think about those scales.
All right. And maybe don't think too much about it.
You also look out into the sky and see that, you know, our galaxy has 200 billion stars. So, you know, one way to think about it is we are just one of them, and they're, you know, the universe is a very vast place, and it can help put things into perspective. It can also cause some distress.
All right. And now, of course, Caroline, this summer, normally you welcome people into the Van Allen Observatories. Mm-hmm. And this summer, because of COVID-19, yeah, things are different. So you have come up with a way to virtually welcome people to Van Allen Observatories. Tell me about your plan.
Yes, so we're really excited. 4 days, evenings in June. This is going to be June 12th, 13th, 26th, and 27th. We're going to have virtual astronomy nights and virtual observing nights. So we'll have some astronomy talks, astronomy lectures, but then, weather permitting, we'll observe virtually online with the University of Iowa's telescope in Arizona. We do have one on campus, but this is the telescope we'll be using is in Arizona. And so the public will be able to request, what do you want to see? If you go onto the Talk of Iowa's webpage, there's a link to our events where you can email to sign up for the virtual observing and astronomy nights. And you can also request targets that you might like to see the observatory observe.
And tell me about the telescope in Arizona. What can we see through this telescope?
Yes. So, you know, as I was saying, our eyes can only see a few thousand stars, but the time that you install the telescope, we really can see tens of thousands of targets. So we can see stars. We'll talk about that on our second night, but we can also see objects in our solar system. We'll look at some comets in particular. In the fall, the planets are up and the planets can be seen. We can also look at other types of objects in our Milky Way galaxy. So Cornelia mentioned how when our sun dies, it will explode into a planetary nebula. We'll be able to see some beautiful planetary nebulae here in our Milky Way galaxy. And we can even see other galaxies outside of our Milky Way galaxy. We'll look at some of those on our last night.
All right. And we're going to have to stay up late to do this, right? It begins at 9
yes.
o'clock?
That's right. Sunset in Arizona is about 7 p.m. And with the time difference, that puts us here in Iowa at about 9 p.m. for our start time. Unfortunately, but, you know, hopefully everyone can find a way to, you know, make a special occasion or sleep in the next morning. They're on weekend nights.
Right, right. And it's summer. We can do that.
That is one of the challenges with younger kids and observing in the summer. I've lived this over many years with my children. You think, oh, it's summer, it'll be great, but it doesn't get dark till, especially during June, till very late at night. So you have to plan for it.
Well, and Cornelia, what are some ways to really have this stargazing experience? In addition to the virtual astronomy nights at the Van Allen Observatories, what are some great ways for families to have some of these adventures? I know that I have very fond memories of getting up in the middle of the night and watching a meteor shower with my dad, right, even though it was cold and I was tired. what are some good ideas?
Some good accessories are a cozy blanket, and blankets have just gotten cozier over the years with all these fleece options, so make sure you have cozy blankets. Hot chocolate's always a good idea. And I know Carolyn is a big advocate of this, too. I think a lot of families can do a lot of astronomy watching using fairly simple binoculars, even sometimes the kind that are good for bird watching are great home astronomy devices, so to speak. And it's not necessary to go out and buy a small telescope. A lot of times, especially with children and a little bit unsteady hands, having an adult there to hold the binoculars and help them see things like craters on the moon can be very, very rewarding. We've done that over the years, just even from our porch in town, where you have a small child sit on your lap and you can kind of steady their view and you can help adjust by looking at the moon. So I would say that blankets, refreshments, and finding a dark spot is really important. And there are some dark spots in town. You have to kind of sometimes work around the lighting. Driving north out of Iowa City, there's some nice country roads you can pull out in and just set up a little spot by your car. If you, the Palisade Dowse Observatory, which is part of Linn County, it's just past Solon, has a really nice facility. They're not currently doing a lot of public nights because of the COVID situation, but even pulling up into that general part of north of Iowa City is nice because there's some hills there that block the lights from Cedar Rapids. And so there's places you can pull out and spread out a blanket and spend a couple hours.
All right. So no matter where you are in Iowa, you may have to do a little bit of driving, but that's one of the nice things about Iowa is we do have some dark skies here. Now, last weekend, a lot of us had the opportunity to watch the SpaceX rocket take off. And that was a very exciting moment because, of course, it's been a number of years since 2011 since U.S. astronauts have actually launched into space from U.S. soil. Cornelia, with that moment, tell me how you're feeling about the space program and the future of space exploration.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, it was very exciting to watch. I watched with my family, and I think there's some very exciting possibilities going forward in terms of the partnership between NASA and the private sector. I think these things have gotten expensive enough, and NASA's funding has not been overly increased to the level it would need to be to really do the research and development for the human spaceflight. And I think in some senses, it's more appropriate to do that privately and then for NASA to contract out, which is what's happening with SpaceX. I think this is a really kind of exciting new direction. I will say that a lot of astronomers aren't as excited about humans going into space simply because we can do so much with robots. You know, you think about most of the instruments we use are robotic, so there's no humans involved in those endeavors. And when you add humans into the picture, it really puts the cost up very high.
So in some ways, the human space exploration might get in the way of what we can learn. Is that what you're saying?
Sometimes. I mean, there's I'm in support of it. There's a natural human curiosity. I'm looking forward to the day when a more diverse set of people go into space as well to represent our planet more appropriately. But I think Professor Van Allen, who was in our department for many years at the helm, was very strongly against humans in space as a scientific endeavor. And so I think a lot of us still carry some of those beliefs when we walk the hallways of Van Allen Hall. We believe that to do things cost effectively and scientifically rich, you can do a lot of that stuff robotically.
Well, and let's talk about some of the robotic exploration. And, you know, we may have some listeners who aren't familiar with some of the really exciting things that have happened in recent years. But what are the robotic exploration missions that have been most exciting to you?
Well, I think we have, again, as Caroline pointed out earlier, there's a part of our solar system that gets a little underrepresented. These are these objects like dwarf planets, asteroids, comets. And over the years, there have been some recent, really interesting missions where we have landed on a comet. We have taken samples with aerogel of comet dust and brought them back to Earth. We have crashed into an asteroid. These are, of course, objects that are on a trajectory that takes them close to Earth. So I think sometimes those missions don't get as much airtime. I think a lot of us are very excited about Mars 2020, which will be launching in early July. I think it's on July 4th. That tends to be a good launch window and a kind of a national day here. And so people should stay tuned for that. It'll take about 6 months for Mars 2020 to land on Mars, and it will be the most sophisticated rover ever to explore a crater on Mars that is thought to be at the base of a river system, an ancient river system that, of course, has dried up. And there's seven instruments on that rover. Each of them has an amazing suite of goals related to looking for early life on Mars.
So we could have a lot of incredible images and information coming back to us from there. Caroline, with just a couple of moments left, I mean, the internet has given us so much access to the kinds of equipment that scientists use and the images that scientists used to be the only ones who could really see these images. How do you suggest people who want to learn more really get involved and explore?
Yeah, fantastic. One of the great things these days is something called citizen science. And so there are a number of websites, but the one that comes to mind is called Zooniverse. Different ways for the public to get involved in using this big data that's out there and help with the science projects. So Zooniverse has a number of astronomy projects where citizens can use the data coming back from these missions and really contribute.
All right. So we can actually get involved in some of this research as well. I remember my husband spending a lot of time on SETI at home looking for alien life forms by using his computer processor many years ago. He did not discover any alien life forms. There are so many. It just sparks our imagination to look up into the night sky and to think about space and to think about all of those other planets and those other galaxies. Cornelia, I know that it's also a little bit overwhelming. So do you have any thoughts on where somebody maybe should start?
Well, I think actually one of the best places to start is trying to understand how those pieces fit together. And there's so many great resources online. There's beautiful children's books and young adult books that show, but I think that illustrate these things. But I really think trying to get together a roadmap, if you will, or a universal atlas, to take us back to your first question, would be an endeavor really worth digging into, the way that the different pieces connect.
All right. Well, thank you both so much for being here today. And again, I want to mention the virtual observing nights at the Van Allen Observatories Friday, June 12th and Saturday, June 13th. And then again, another weekend of learning and observation Saturday, June 26th and Saturday, June 27th. If you go to our website, iowapublicradio.org, and find the web post about today's program, you can find links to those events. You can also find them on Facebook as well and become a part of those observations. And of course, you can also do a lot of exploring on your own. Cornelia Lang, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Charity. This is wonderful.
And Caroline Roberts, thank you.
Thank you so much for having us, Charity.
Cornelia Lang, Professor and Director of Undergraduate Studies in the Physics and Astronomy Department at the University of Iowa, and Caroline Roberts, Astronomy Laboratory Coordinator and Van Allen Observatories Manager at the University of Iowa. And again, Talk of Iowa Summer Camp will be every Tuesday morning at 10 all summer long. We'll have different themes every week. And if you have suggestions for themes you'd like us to explore, send us an email, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe. We'll